So that's why I decided to quit my six-figure job, taking 80% salary reduction, which is crazy.
Welcome back to our brand new series of 40 Minute Mentor, your pocket-sized career mentor on a mission to raise aspirations and inspire the next generation of category-defining founders. From purpose-led entrepreneurs to world-class investors and even Olympic champions, you'll learn firsthand from today's successful leaders on what it takes to be brilliant, all in just 40 minutes. Today, we're joined by Gary Izunwa, co-founder and CEO of Tangent, an employee referral platform that makes referrals accessible to everyone, not just the privileged few with the best networks. Prior to Tangent, Gary worked at LinkedIn and the British Council, leading programs for Generation UK, a multi-million pound campaign committed to social mobility by providing UK students from low-income backgrounds with funded work opportunities in China. Most recently, Gary has been named in the 2024 class of Forbes 30 Under 30 for Social Impact, a much-deserved recognition and one of many more to come, I'm sure. I've had the pleasure of knowing Gary for a little while now, and I am a huge fan of his, and I really love Tangent's mission. So I am super excited to finally welcome him onto the podcast, to hear more about Tangent, and to discuss the power of mentorship and social mobility together.
Gary, thank you so much for joining us on 40 Minute Mentor. We've known each other for a little while now, and I am incredibly excited for our audience to hear all about Tangent and your career story. But before we sort of dive into all of those things, let's get you warmed up. You know what's coming. Question one. The most memorable day in my career was when?
I'd probably say at the time at LinkedIn, I had finishing off Q4 2020. So I was working in sales. And yeah, finishing that quarter off, I became the first sales rep in LinkedIn history to ever hit a quarterly target only with multi-year contracts. So in that particular quarter, I didn't sell any 12-month or, you know, as contract as standard, I only sold 24 or 36 months. So I think I sold like 20 odd deals that quarter. So yeah, that was definitely a kind of a highlight in my career. And I still think that hasn't been beaten.
Love that. Love that. World record holder. Well, we're going to talk a bit more about some sales stuff because I think that would be amazing for anybody that's sort of embarking on that career. But that's a great start. Thank you. One word others would use to describe me is
ambitious.
Yes. Yeah. I see that. And I think that will come across in absolute spades and a great trait of a founder. So good stuff. My biggest failure to date is
I try not to think about failure and more about like learnings. That's how I kind of like to frame things. But I'd say, so years ago now, maybe like 7 or so years ago, I was shortlisted for this like really competitive like scholarship program. I met the billionaire that like was running it, had lunch with him and everything. Like it was a really cool experience. It was kind of like mine to lose in a way, but I just kind of like bombed the interview. So it was like you're interviewing with really esteemed people, like, you know, heads of like, I mean, one of the interviewers was like the former vice chancellor of like Oxford. So, you know, really like esteemed people in like society and business. So it's quite intimidating and didn't get it. I mean, in many ways it's, you know, you look back and it's quite fortuitous because had I had, did get that scholarship, I wouldn't be doing all the things I'm doing now. But that's really one of the things that, you know, went for, didn't get, bit of a bum at the time, but you look back and you're fortunate.
Yeah, definitely. I love the way I really like that way of reframing mistakes as learnings. And, you know, sometimes those, we all have to have things that don't go away, really, don't we? To kind of give perspective and also help us upskill and like go again and hopefully learn from it. So that's a really interesting example. I measure success by
value creation. Probably sounds a bit like jargony, but I think that if you understand what value is between entities to different parties or whatever, and then you can create that, I think that's like great things come from that. Impact comes from that. Revenue generation comes from that, etc. I think if you can create value for people, groups, entities, etc., anything good kind of stems from there. So yeah, that's how I measure success.
Love that. Final quick fire question. If there was one thing I could change about entrepreneurship, it would be?
Oh, easy. How network driven it is. Like fundraising, finding talent, you know, making your initial sales. I mean, so much that comes down to like who you know. That determines how successful you can be in those early days, how you get your first invest, et cetera, et cetera. It's extremely network driven. It's very much who you know and not what you know. Yeah. And somehow, some way that needs to change.
Yeah, and it excludes so many, doesn't it? Deserve the opportunity to have the same shot, but just don't because of the networks they have. Yeah, I totally agree. Well, we're going to talk a lot about Tangent, which is disrupting some of these things, but we'll come on to that. I don't want to get too excited. We've got to start at the beginning, Gary, before we get to that. Do you mind telling us a bit about your upbringing? I'd love to understand what that was like, what your early career aspirations were, and particularly how it shaped you into the person you are today. And one of the things I wanted to ask linked to that was just, did entrepreneurship feel like an attainable thing for you back when you were a kid? Was it even of interest?
Sure, yeah, I'll start from the very beginning. So yeah, I grew up kind of low income, single parent family, you know, preschool meals. You know, I'm one of five children. And, you know, again, my mother is amazing, worked extremely hard, sacrificed a lot. But, you know, when you're one of five kids, you know, she can't give you all the time, as well as trying to survive herself and do everything. You can't get all her, you can't get her undivided attention, basically. So from a very young age, I've had to be, I had to learn to be very proactive. You know, I couldn't wait around for things to just kind of come my way. I have to go out and seek things, you know, opportunities or just whatever. So that's like definitely something that's kind of stemmed up in my life today, that proactive nature. I'm very much a go-getter, going, making things kind of happen for me. But since then, you know, I've gone through quite upwardly of our journey. So I did, you know, did well in school, like all A's, my A-levels, got into my first choice uni, a scholarship, and things have kind of worked out since. But I do kind of look back at my early years and a lot of the traits that I have, and kind of the mission that I'm on now definitely stems from that. If I was saying about entrepreneurship, it's an interesting one because I remember growing up watching things like Dragon's Den and, you know, that was always cool and people coming in and creating businesses and getting investment. And that always seemed really cool. And it definitely felt like something that I would do eventually, but it wasn't something that I kind of specifically was looking for. Because I think when you come from a kind of a low income, you know, kind of background, at least for me, one of the key ways of kind of improving my life and moving from the circumstances I was born into was just to get a good job, to get a good career. So I was very, very career focused as opposed to, like, you know, entrepreneurship minded growing up. It was get a good job and just kind of live your life through that way. And in many ways I was quite successful. You know, I got the coveted internships at big banks and media companies, started my career in a big tech company. It was only as I got older I became more aware of some of the issues in the world that I then started to look at entrepreneurship more specifically. So yes and no, I kind of think.
Interesting. Yeah, really. Thank you for sharing that. And you mentioned you started your career on LinkedIn's grad scheme, which is really prestigious, highly sought after. And you ended up joining the sales team, which, as you've already alluded to, you excelled massively in creating some incredible records. Tell us a bit, if you don't mind, about that experience at LinkedIn, because I know you're very fond of the business at the company. What were some of the biggest learnings from that experience, the biggest highlights, and anything about why it was such a formative experience for you?
Yeah, I definitely kind of landed on my seat at LinkedIn. It was an incredible company. So I joined there in September 2016 as one of nine associates on their business leadership program. Beautiful, like, beautiful company, amazing experience. So the BLP, as it's kind of like abbreviated to, if you like, the acronym, is you rotate around different business units. So I rotate around recruitment to customer operations, then obviously into sales. And some of the biggest learnings around that is it gave me a real holistic perspective on how the non-technical elements of business kind of work in tandem towards working towards the kind of the overarching goals of the business. Gave me a real appreciation for how these kind of seemingly disparate business units actually, in kind of interesting ways, work together to achieve common outcomes. I think just about LinkedIn is that LinkedIn fits the cult and culture. People at LinkedIn bleed blue, or at least they did when I was there. I'm not sure how it is, you know, post-pandemic and layoffs and so forth, but there was just something about, you know, I was based in Dublin, the European, the EMEA HQ, and in the HQ there were people from all different backgrounds, right? Different cultures, Spanish, Dutch, German, Italian, you know, everywhere. But there was just something about the way in which they recruited that, even though everyone was quite different by virtue of culture and upbringing, there was this like common thread around how people like behaved and treated people. So it was just a really beautiful place to work. Everyone was really friendly. You know, some of my best friends still to this day, and I know for forever really, are one of my former colleagues. You know, and I really looked forward to going to work every day. Like this idea of like going to work 5 days a week, you know, in the office was just totally like, it was not even just normal. It was like, for me, coveted. I was looking forward to it. So there was just something around the way in which they hired people. And they were very specific about that, clearly, that there was this connectedness across everybody, regardless of your background. That's made it for just a really, really exciting place and fun place to work.
Yeah, great place to sort of start your career and build meaningful connections and friendships for the future, which is so important at the beginning of your career. You can really, I always find that you meet people that really hate their first jobs, and perhaps that spurs them on in different ways. But then you find others that it's just such a impactful experience.
In some ways, I was ruined because, like, once you start there, it's like,
it's hard to compete.
Where do you go next?
Yeah, where do you go next? Yeah, it's so true, though. That's so true. I think that is, that's definitely, there'll be people listening to this that have had an experience that they've struggled to match thereafter. And a good, you know, the grass isn't always greener, right?
But we had free food, a free gym, an on-site masseuse, like it was so.
Oh my God.
Do you know what I mean? And I was 22.
Loved that. Yeah. I mean, living the dream, living the dream. You did become, you know, one of the highest performing account execs in EMEA. And I did want to ask you a bit about what it was that made you successful at the sales side, because there are going to be potentially recent graduates listening to this or people in the earlier parts of their sales career now who are probably hearing that going, that's where I want to be. So how did you have the impact you did? And do you have any tips, tricks, or just a piece of advice or mentorship for anyone that might be in that position right now?
I've got a lot of these things. Like, I don't think any of the advice is going to be like revolutionary. It's kind of like hackneyed in some way, but some of the things that I did specifically would be that I'm a firm believer in that everything in life at this point has been done already. I don't have to necessarily make the mistakes myself to learn them. I can just ask people who have been in those positions or positions that I'm getting into or going into and just extract their experiences and extract their knowledge. So when I first started as an account exec, I just identified all the top performers and just was absorbed all the information I could from them, whether it was shadowing their calls, you know, looking at their email template, just sat down with them and got them to buy into me, and you know, it was really clear that I was keen to learn and develop and grow. And I think when you have that kind of, when you give off that impression, I think people want to help you. It's like a lot more fun and exciting to help someone who's really keen to grow and develop, and you can be a part of that journey than someone who isn't. But yeah, that was one thing I did very early on. I just started just sitting with the top performers, listening to their calls, what type of emails they were sending, just learning from them really, and that's probably not revolutionary, but it definitely helped me. And then I think the second thing is, again, which is quite, you know, I think in a lot of tech companies, they advocate, it's like, if having like this growth mindset is just always thinking about how you can do things better, how you can do things differently, you know, never being fixed, looking at things that have already been done in a certain way and thinking, okay, how can I do it differently? The thing with the multi-year deal thing was that was, I mean, I was quite, you know, it was very, very difficult. Definitely wasn't easy to hit that kind of target in that way, but it was just looking at it as a challenge that could be achieved, as opposed to this like unsurmountable or insurmountable kind of like task that no one's ever done, so I couldn't. So I think just having this kind of growth mindset, you know, always looking for ways to develop yourself and actively seeking out those opportunities, that definitely helped myself. I can get into like tactical things, but I think that's like the bedrock for me, is like really absorbing that info and that kind of experience from previous top performers, and then always just having that big like growth mindset. That sets you up, I think. Well, I think if you do that, you'll always be in a good position.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's great advice. I think your growth mindset is evident from the moves you've made. So you were kind of a six-figure job at LinkedIn. You left to join the British Council to lead social mobility programs, which is like that's a big call to make at that time of your life and career. But clearly, you have this passion for social mobility, which we're going to come on to talk about, you know, and you had an experience there, which is completely different to working in a big tech company. And then you've gone on to set up Tangent, your own business. So before we come on to talk about Tangent, just how seminal was that experience of the British Council for you? What was the reason for taking the plunge and moving to such a different environment? What was driving you there?
Yeah. So yeah, it was a big move. You know, I was, you know, by the time I was 24, 25, I was earning well into the six figures at LinkedIn, which for me was crazy, right? Growing up on free school meals and earning that much money at that age group, it was like, I've really hit the jackpot here. Like, this is great. And yeah, so moving to the British Council. So the motivation there was, so I was based in Dublin, right? I was living in Dublin, Ireland, where I was at LinkedIn. But every 8 or so weeks, I would come back home to London, you know, just to see my family and see my friends. And there was this like interesting experience almost every time, where, you know, I would reflect and realize that I'm living this really cool life in Dublin. I'm living in a really nice apartment. I get to go on really nice holidays and stay in really nice hotels. When I'd come back home, my immediate family's life hadn't changed. And the friends that I went to school with, you know, their lives hadn't changed. And all these people, I can promise you now, work equally, if not more hard than I do. And I wouldn't say it was guilt, but there was this kind of tension of, I'm between one plane ride. I'm going from this like really nice life to this like not as nice life, you know, and it just frustrated me. And I just saw so much talent and so many great people who just didn't have the same opportunities and quite frankly luck as I had. And doing that journey a number of times, it just like, well, it kind of like overwhelmed me and it made me realize that I think I've learned a lot around how to be up and demobile, how to navigate these foreign corporate spaces. And I want to share that knowledge with others from social backgrounds like mine. But it's not really that fun being like one of the few at the top. I mean, I think some people kind of like, not that I was at the top, you know what I mean? I think some people laud being in that position. But for me, I would rather be in a position like that, if you like, being at the top or being in a better position with people from backgrounds like mine. You know, it's just a lot more enjoyable. And so just that after a while just made me realize I want to have more of an impactful career. You know, I can take risk, I'm only 25. So that's why I decided to quit my six-figure job, taking 80% salary reduction, which is crazy, you know. It was that quality of life drop significantly. And then I moved to the British Council because they approached me to kind of lead these social mobility programs. Effectively, what we did is we gave low-income university graduates and students funded work opportunities abroad. So they got that work experience, but also that international experience to boost their employability. And that was just, it's such a unique role. It was originally based in Beijing, China. So it's just a lot of things that I was just like, this role is really interesting. I get to go to a completely different part of the world. I get to live abroad again, like take the plunge and see. And so I did. And yeah, British Council was a very interesting experience, very different from, obviously LinkedIn. And I 100% expected that. I did not go into it thinking that it would be even remote and similar, but it was actually very different. Going to a place that, you know, really, really focuses on values, culture, and LinkedIn, and then to a different. It was very interesting. I learned a lot. It really cemented my interest and passion in the social mobility space, and that's kind of what spurred me on to what I'm doing today.
Yeah, it's a perfect segue to talk about Tangent. Tell us about the kind of how it came to be, and you and your co-founder Joe created the business. So, what was the original inspiration? There's something in the story around learning from your mistakes around applying for jobs and that sort of stuff. So, I'd love to hear a bit about how you both met and how that business came to be.
Yeah, for sure. So the British Council was a very interesting experience and somewhat a difficult one. It had to happen because one of the alumna of the programs that I was managing, we got to know each other. We worked together doing some like alumni work. And then we finished that. And then she went on to be the recruiter for this company called Zinc VC. And Zinc is, for those that know, it's a venture builder. Basically, they find people from around the world, aspiring entrepreneurs. They put all people together as individuals. You find your co-founder on the program and then you kind of build businesses from there. And had I not gone to the British Council and met this person who then went on to be the recruiter for Zinc, I would have never have learned about Zinc. It just wouldn't have come across me naturally. I wasn't looking for these things. But she approached me and said, we'll just open applications for our most recent program. I think you'd be a good fit to apply. And so had she not done that, we just wouldn't be speaking today. So even though it was an interesting experience at the British Council, it definitely had to happen. And then, so yeah, join Zinc, you join as an individual, you kind of date, if you like, they call it like Love Island meets the apprentice. And kind of just tried relationships or co-founder relationships with a lot of different people, met Joe, and that's kind of where we kind of sparked together. And we both come from low socioeconomic backgrounds. And so that was definitely the connection. And, you know, kind of applying for jobs and the kind of the job market being quite unfair and very much kind of network driven and kind of predicated on nepotism. That was something that bonded us. And so we wanted to tackle that. We've had varying degrees of success in our career in sort of getting good jobs. We thought we could change that. We ideated on a lot of different things. And then we kind of settled on my experience at LinkedIn, where not just LinkedIn, but a lot of tech companies, a vast majority of their hiring comes from employee referrals. I didn't know what an employee referral was until I started working at LinkedIn. Prior to that, I thought the only way you can get a job is that you apply for a job on a job board, right? Like, I didn't even know this was like this whole nepotistic recruitment channel that existed in plain sight was a thing. And what I saw when I was looking at LinkedIn is that, you know, it was oftentimes my private school colleagues would just refer their private school friends, they would coach them through interview processes and they'd land these top tech jobs. And, you know, these people are already good people, they're nothing wrong with them, but it just felt so unfair that access to these top tech companies that can provide like life-changing incomes and opportunities was only really available to a select few people that had certain networks. And so we just ideated around that. And that's how we kind of fell on Tangent as a solution to that, where we can connect job seekers from backgrounds specifically like mine to employees within those tech companies so they can develop their connections, their networks, and then hopefully get referred into their companies too. So that's kind of how Tangent came about and how Joe and I fell on the idea.
Such an amazing, it's a great story. I love how the British Council experience indirectly led you to starting your business, and then the mission is something that I am wholeheartedly supportive of. I think it's really, really important. I guess for those that don't know, what is your perfect customer What can any listeners expect from signing up? It'd be great just to understand a bit more about the mechanics of it and also what impact Tangent is having for companies. Because I'm hoping from this episode, you're going to get a swathe of new customers off the back of it.
Oh, we should hope. So at a high level, Tangent is an employee referral platform, a kind of short-term mentoring platform that makes referrals accessible to everyone and not just a privileged few with the best networks, right? And so what that means in practice is that we connect job seekers from low socioeconomic background to employees within tech companies who can refer them in. We're actually starting with just one role, it's sales development or business development representative. And so we find aspiring kind of BDRs and SDRs. They come onto Tangent, they submit a video pitch around 60 to kind of 90 seconds in length, where they say why they're interested in a career in tech sales, why they know they're a good match for it, their previous experience that aligns to it. And then these video pitches can be viewed by employees within tech companies who we call mentors, who can decide based on the video pitches that they viewed, who they think could be a good match, who they want to support, and eventually or potentially even refer them in for any open role. So we act as the broker or the facilitator between the job seeker and the employee and kind of create that connection between them. In terms of the impact that we've had to date, so, you know, we've even kind of early out the gate when we kind of launched our MVP, we were able to kind of sign really good logos like Go Cardless and Multiverse on as customers who both made hires, SDR hires, within like 3 weeks of kind of using Tangent. What was really powerful about the Go Cardless story is that the talent partner there almost verbatim said to us that had she seen the person they hired, had she seen his CV, she would have passed on him because he'd been out of work for a while. There was just a bit of red flags that just wouldn't have immediately caught her attention. But actually coming to Tangent, seeing his video pitch, that's what got him noticed. That's what got him in the interview process. And that's what got him hired. So these kind of antiquated methods of assessing talent, CVs and cover letters, if they don't work for everyone because we aren't always ticking those boxes or oftentimes are getting filtered out by some sort of AI, whereas video, if presented in the right format, can really raise awareness or give recruiters and talent partners better visibility of all available talent. And, you know, this person was a first-generation immigrant, first-gen student, and he started on a 30K plus salary. And so that's like a big, you know, story. And we've got numerous stories like that from people that got hired to Multiverse and so forth. In terms of customers, so yeah, we're very focused, you know, the marketplace as we are. You've got to constrain your focus. And so we're very much starting with this kind of tech sales space, the SDR, the BDRs for now in London. A private customer for us to be, you know, someone that's, you know, 200 people plus B2B SaaS company that hires, you know, 2 to 3, 4, 5 BDRs a year. That's someone that we know we can work with and we can have impact for and have already and will continue to.
It's amazing. It's so great. I think recruitment needs evolving and it's been unfair for a long time. And it's just so great to see how quickly you're having this sort of impact around this one area. But I'm sure we'll come on to talk a bit about what the future holds for Tanya, but I'm sure there's going to be lots more people across multiple functions that, you know, benefiting from it.
Big expansion plans.
Love that. Well, hold it back for now because I want to tease the audience with the future plans. But I guess we all know that building a startup is bloody hard work and it's never the kind of unicorns and, you know, everything goes perfect. But you've already received some great traction. You know, you mentioned the sorts of clients you've already got on board, the impact that it's having and everything that I've seen, you're absolutely flying. But do you mind taking us back to those kind of earlier days though? What was it like behind the scenes, those first few months? What were some of the challenges you had to overcome, some of the hardest parts of the build or any particular mistakes you make? Because we want to tell the realistic version of the story for anyone that's going through it right now.
Yeah, for sure. And you hit the nail on the head. It's so hard. Like, this is by far the hardest thing I've ever done. It's weird because I love it, but it's incredibly challenging. A few things that come to mind is, so once you are invited to join Zinc's portfolio, they give you like an initial bit of investment to like get your proof of concept, you know, just get you off the ground to help you raise your next round of funding, which we have raised a pre-seed round, but you know, the amount of money you get isn't like huge, let's say. So we got given around 65K, I think. You got to try and make that stretch. And so when we did, we made that 65K in May of 2022. We made that last until June 2023. Whilst paying ourselves. Obviously, you can imagine we weren't paying ourselves much. But so in that and whole time of building our MVP, getting traction, making sales and having our customers be successful, making hires, you know, we were basically paying ourselves nothing and had to maintain and build our product. You know, neither myself and my co-founder Joe are technical, so we had to get really creative on how we could build these things. And so that was a challenge. You know, a lot of my friends still work in sales and lots of money. You know, I'm talking 200K plus salary or incomes. you know, when they're going on these really nice lavish holidays and so forth, and they're inviting you and you just have to say, I can't, or I cannot afford to go. It's tough, you know. It's not, this is the first one, probably it's not the worst thing in the world, but it is a challenge. And that's one thing. I think another challenge as well is, I mean, one of the biggest lessons I have with, you know, kind of building products, building businesses, is that you should never build in isolation of your members or your users or anything like that. So, and that's what we did initially. So when we first built our MVP, we had an idea in our head that this is an amazing product, so it's totally going to work. You know, we built this in isolation though of our members. So, you know, the design, and basically what happened was we built it, we got people, we were able to attract, you know, job seekers. We had a really high conversion from our waiting list onto the product. People actually signed up. But the product experience was so bad. I mean, it was awful that no one did the things we wanted, like nobody. And so it was that, and actually, so that August, September, those few months of 2022 was really difficult because we were just trying to push people through the funnel, like just do looking to push through, get them through. But we hadn't really solved the actual problem, which we come to learn was that people couldn't see the value. They didn't see, you know, and creating a video pitch for a job, it's quite a high friction thing to do. And so they weren't seeing the value. But we because we built in isolation of our members, we didn't understand that. And so for like two or so months, nothing was happening. And it was very dark. You know, it was like, this isn't going to work. We need to pivot, et cetera. But then we went back to just actually, you know, basic support. Okay, let's just get this in front of people. We'll talk to them and see what they think. And from that kind of rapid kind of member research, user research phase, if you like, we were then able to learn what you needed to do to get people to go through it. And then it kind of took off from there. But that was a very difficult time where you built something. People are signing up, but they're not doing anything on the product. And you're kind of not really sure why. But it's a fundamental lesson because now everything we do is member and user informed. We do not do anything without working with our members and showing things before we move forward. So a good lesson to have early on in the journey, but definitely a hard one at the same time.
Yeah, really, really interesting. Really powerful lesson there for other founders listening that might be going down a similar path. And I think it's really amazing to hear how you managed to make 65K stretch that long. I think, do you think that discipline has been really important for you and is something that other founders listening to this should maybe think about? Because do you think it would have been different if you'd have had like a massive, massive check, you know, if this is back in the heady days of 21, would that have changed things for you, do you think?
I think so. That's a good question because, yeah, we had to be very disciplined with how we spent money, but at the same time, we also had to optimize for speed, you know, just to like get things working. And I think because we were able to do that when we were fundraising, it was something that came from conversations, right, that we can make 65K last a long time and also get like really good traction throughout that time as well. And now obviously where the market has changed, where people are, you know, investors and so forth, looking more for like profitability and so forth,
yeah,
and, you know, maintaining cash burn, like we don't know any other world, to be honest.
Yeah.
And so in so many ways I'm very grateful that we didn't raise money in that kind of ZERP era, that 2021 period, because by natural consequence of market conditions we've grown our standards with this mindset. We don't know any other way. And yeah, I think that's going to just allow us to be better going forward.
I really do. I honestly think it's really powerful, both from a frugality mindset and like actually making results, but also the creativity that you've had to use to kind of hustle and make stuff happen and work in a different type of way. I just think that is so powerful.
There with the creativity, because it's like you have to look for new and innovative ways. Like you can't just look at the standard ways that are quite easy. Like, for example, ads. Like, we just don't even think about ads when it comes to it. Like member acquisition, we just have to like think really deeply and critically of where are our members or our target members? How can we like in this non-scalable but like still efficient way, like find them? We've now actually got some really, it takes a while to find them, but we've got some really cool like growth hacks to acquire, but a repeatable growth hacks to find both sides of our marketplace that we can replicate in any location, any city, any country that we want. But that came with the consequence of we have to be very focused on our mind. If we did raise lots of money, we could have said, you know, let's just do ads.
Yeah.
A very expensive way to do things. So yeah, I think it'll definitely benefit us moving forward.
For sure. And it really reminds me of just like as a bootstrap founder myself, just it takes me back. It really does take me back. And it's still kind of at the heart of how we do things now. We trial stuff and it doesn't always work, but you've just got to be continually thinking creatively. And yeah, I love that. I want to talk a bit about referrals. It would be silly not to really. You know, we've leveraged referrals. I mean, we've always tried to get referrals from a really diverse cross-section of our network, but inherently there's biases that will always creep in, I think, from the way that we do it and have done it, albeit it's really helped us grow. So I'd love to get your thoughts on why you think referrals are powerful, but also where do businesses go wrong when using referrals? Because it's clearly flawed in the way that it currently is done for most companies.
So I think it's important to note that I think referrals are a great talent acquisition source, right? They are. Factually, they are, right? You know, I think it's like referrals are a cheaper source of hire, they're a quicker source of hire, and referred candidates stay longer in companies. Like, there's just so much data that suggests this. Hence why 82% of companies rank them as their best hiring channel. Mm. So I think if referrals as it, like, in its, as itself, right, as a thing that exists, is not bad. Like, employee referrals are not bad, despite that, sure, what they are. It's just the way in which they currently are kind of employed, if you like, in the sense that it is really only available to a select few people. It's extremely network driven. You know, it's all about, it's to get referred, you have to know people. You know, we spoke to a global tech company, huge, you know, you'd 100% know of this, over 100,000 employees, and 65% of their global recruitment, 65% of all their hires, two-thirds, comes from referrals. For every 100 hires they make, only two comes from a job ad. So 2% of their global hires come from job ads, which is where majority of people from low socioeconomic backgrounds think you don't even get a job. So good luck getting into this company if you don't know someone who works there. Yeah, and this is very common across many tech companies because it's such a really powerful and efficient, scalable recruitment channel. So in itself, it's not so bad, but it's just the fact that it's so network driven and it's predicated on nepotism, like who you know. That's the issue, and that's what we're trying to solve. And I think what companies need to think about when it comes to referrals is that you need to broaden out, I think, what a referral actually is. I think right now, what a referral can be, I mean, right now people kind of optimizing the idea that it has to be someone that you've worked with extremely deeply, or someone that you've known since childhood, right? That's a referral. You can really vouch for them. Whereas I think that referrals can be based on like looser touch points in life. It could be someone that you've met recently, you've spoken to a few times, and they demonstrate the attributes of that will be good for a role, and they can meet your culture. That's probably just as significant as a referral as any other. And to be honest, a lot of referrals today are like that. They are, you know, I've known someone for 20 years and I can vouch for them. They are, you know, I met, this is a friend of a friend of a friend who I've spoken to once or twice. I think they'll be good. I referred them in. And I think just getting comfortable with that, that then will allow opportunity around this hiring channel to spread. And we're seeing that as well. A lot of companies are aware that kind of referrals aren't great. You know, I think there's just so many stats around like the diversity implications on referrals. Like most people that get referred are, you know, are white men and most from privileged backgrounds. So for companies that do want to be diverse, they are looking and a critical sense in this channel. But I think the first thing companies need to do is just think about what is a referral and actually how can we broaden that out to more people. And naturally, the first thing I would say is join tangent.
Yeah, absolutely. No, they absolutely should. I guess your passion for social mobility really, it comes across so much and it's so powerful. And your business is centered around advancing social mobility. And there are going to be people listening to this, I think, really well. But I'd love to get your thoughts on what are the biggest gaps when it comes to social mobility? And particularly any business leaders listening to this, what can they do to help change the narrative, advance social mobility, and to play their part? Because at the end of the day, this is a holistic and a societal thing, but business leaders can play a big part in this. So we'd love to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, load of question. Like the podcast could literally just be on this.
I know.
And I could talk for days, but I'll try and keep it concise. So I think one of the biggest gaps that I see around social mobility is probably around this extreme focus on education. Now, of course, education, and you just mentioned it, like, is important. I wouldn't be where I am today. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to hire if I didn't go to university and get a degree. I think that's changing slightly, but like it is important. But I think we over-index on the significance of education at the cost of other important parts of the social mobility conversation. And we know that education isn't the all kind of all-encompassing panacea, right? Like, you know, the brilliant book called The Class Ceiling, Why It Pays to Be Privileged, by Sam Friedman and Daniel Orison. I definitely recommend anyone who's somewhat interested in this topic to read this book. So many interesting facts. They found that, you know, a working class graduate with a first class degree is still less likely to get into an elite occupation or a top job than a privileged one with a Q2. I don't know how that makes any sense. That is just like a stark rejoinder to this idea of like the meritocratic narrative of education being the all-leveler. You know, even at the apex of education, right, working class Oxford graduates still earn £5,000 less than privileged Oxford graduates in the same set of jobs. So there is this, like, there's this level of, and so you have to think, why is that? Like, why do these things happen? And I really think it comes down to just, it's in some ways a facile, obvious kind of thing, but it's like just the network, I think. It's just the people that you know and the networks that you're in and your access to knowledge and opportunities, right? So I think that's one thing where we need to kind of keep the conversation on education going, but we need to like broaden out that conversation and really get to the crux of it, which I think is people. For me, I know a lot of average people that are in amazing spaces by virtue of like who they know and like the opportunities that kind of fall in their way. And I think that's a huge gap. And I think another thing around when it comes to employers, what they can do is I think a lot of the way talent is still identified is rooted in class. You know, accent, the way you dress, what interests and hobbies you have, how you gesticulate. All these things are kind of subtle, quote-unquote, indicators of talent and potential. And in many cases, it's not true. You know, it's because we inherit class biases and how that is embodied in someone, show up in recruitment practice and show up in recruitment decisions. And that means that people that don't have these kind of commonly held typical indicators of talent miss out on lots of opportunities. And so I think we need to broaden that. What does talent actually mean? Is it that this person, you know, speaks a certain way, so apparently they're intelligent, or they dress a certain way, so they know certain rules and so forth? I think there's just so much around how you actually identify and assess talent and making sure that's very objective and not actually rooted in some sort of bias that you have based on whatever other kind of held beliefs that you do. Mm-hmm. So that's like a very high level thing. I'd say I think we need to broaden out the conversation from education. Education is important, but there are so many other things. Like, you know, if a first class graduate from a low income background can still be less likely than a privileged one of the two. I mean, that's just wild to me. And that's the state of play today. And yeah, I just think we need to like really kind of critically assess why this is happening. It's a big change.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. And I think a big part of Tangent's mission is around career mentorship. I mean, this podcast is all about career mentorship. Yeah. So I know that's something we're both incredibly passionate about. And linked to that and what you just said, there are going to be people listening to this that are fighting against this. They don't have those networks, that they are aspirational people that want to progress and want to have the sorts of careers that they deserve. So what advice or mentorship do you have for them that they might be facing these hurdles that feel unsurmountable at times? What can they do to kind of help themselves and not lose hope in the face of what is unfortunately like a societal thing at the moment?
Yeah, it is. And I'm very aware of, like, I have this LinkedIn series, Mad Fact Mondays, where I share like a shocking fact around socioeconomic background. And it's like bleak. But there is like, and I do this to raise awareness of it, to then encourage other people to get involved in the conversations to make change. And I do see that happening, just quite exciting. And for others that listen to that might feel like, oh, it's just so bad. Like, it's just, I'd say that, you know, there are people that are working on this, myself, and there's a load of other kind of organizations, bodies that are growing up that have come in the last couple of years, really. It's like this real burgeoning trend now, people really getting to understand the impact of this diversity characteristic and wanting to make a change. I'm seeing a lot more companies now even have social mobility ERGs from Amazon, or employee resource groups, that is, from Amazon to Accenture to National Grid. You know, I've done talks at these companies and so forth. It's growing in importance. So I think that's something that, you know, people are taking, becoming aware of this and are taking action on this. One thing I would say to people to help them overcome some of these barriers, and it's an interesting one, this is that there's so many things that prevent social mobility and help kind of hold people back that's outside of your control. But there's one thing that I find is within your control. And it centers around this kind of phenomenon that a friend of mine called Polly Oke, she now heads up D&I at Diageo, she's coined as the gratitude complex. Now, the gratitude complex is this kind of phenomenon, if you like, of this feeling that people from socially mobile professionals feel, in the sense that, you know, you've grown up low income, preschool meal, single parent plan, whatever it is, but you've now become socially mobile. You're not working in a company where you're perhaps earning more money than even your parents did. Like, you've out-earned your parents, and you might even still be quite young at this point. And because you've been able to be socially mobile and you're earning all this money that you've never seen before in your lifetime, your family's lifetime, you become very grateful, right? You become very grateful for this company that's provided you this opportunity and this salary. And because you're so grateful, you then actually start to ask for less. You don't push for that promotion. You don't push for that pay rise because, like, you're just happy that you're there.
That's interesting.
And actually, if you push, then you might actually make some noise and find out, and they might find out that you're actually there, and they might actually think that they made a mistake hiring you, and they might actually get rid of you. So, you know, there's this concept of being found out that I actually shouldn't be here. So you actually don't make much noise. And so I think the gratitude complex, it keeps people from low income backgrounds where they are. That's what contributes towards pay gaps, progression gaps, and so forth. And I definitely felt this. Getting into LinkedIn, as great as it was, I was just like, look, I'm just happy to be here. You know, I don't want to leave. You know, like, I don't want to rock the boat so much that they take this away from me. And it's genuinely really scary to think that, right? This one company is taking this one risk. For people that feel this feeling, because I know it is quite common, I think people oftentimes feel this, not even knowing that it's a thing. And so I'm sure there'll be people that will hear this and be like, wow, I actually resonate with this. I didn't even know there was a term for this type of thing. Is that you have to get comfortable asking for what you want. It is uncomfortable, but you have to push. A lot of my friends now, their great friends, are privileged, and they have no qualms at all asking for what they want. In fact, they believe that they deserve it. And so you have to almost reset your mind and teach yourself that same thing. Like, no company is hiring you for banter. Like, if you're in seat, they think that there's something that you can contribute. to do that. And when you do that, ask for what you deserve. If that's a pay rise, if that promotion, push for it. Oftentimes, I think a lot of people, low social backgrounds, you're waiting for a manager to approach you for recognize your hard work and then give you that promotion. It's just, if you're waiting, you can wait for a very long time. Yeah. So you need to be ambitious and go for it. That doesn't mean you're going to get it the first time. You have to push a couple of times before you get it. But about pushing, about being candid and being direct in that sense, I think that you'll find that you're just slowly kind of falling behind your peers who aren't necessarily that much better than you. The performance could be equal, if not they're the worst, but they're pushing for it. They're getting, they're in spaces where they're seen, visibility, the whole thing as well. There's just so much around that, the gratitude complex, pushing for what you want, being visible in the work office that contributes towards like career success. And that's one thing I'll help people to kind of focus on.
Love that. Thank you so much for sharing, Gary. I'm sure that's going to be really helpful for a lot of people listening to this that might have needed that pep talk from you today. So thank you. But we're sadly getting towards the end. And before we talk through the final three wrap-up questions, I just wanted to quickly ask about the future. I know you're a very ambitious person and you alluded to being a lot ahead. So talk us through what the grand plan for Tangent is over the next sort of 5 to 10 years. Where do you want to be and what impact do you want to have?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for asking. So for us, you know, we're on a relentless mission to really create a world where the social context you're born into do not determine your career outcomes, because quite frankly, right now they do. I think what's really important in our mission is that it's the focus on career outcomes, in the sense that career outcomes are not just kind of constrained to recruitment, right? Your career is influenced, you know, once you're in a company as well, right? And actually a lot of opportunities or kind of influence on your career, it still stems from your internal network. So we see a massive opportunity to provide products and solutions across the entire talent management lifecycle. So from recruiting to L&D to internal mobility, there's a whole suite of solutions that we believe can be provided to companies that allows companies and employees to realize their full potential, primarily through this kind of human to human peer interaction kind of philosophy that we have at Tangent, but does so in a way that makes like the world of work a lot fairer. And there's this kind of world renowned, if you like, professor called Raj Shetty. And a couple of years ago, he did this research and found that the single most important indicator of someone being so socially mobile is what they call economic connectedness, which refers to the share of wealthy friends that a poor person has. The idea is that if you have more rich friends, that they can act as bridges towards knowledge, opportunities, and other networks, right? And we put that at the core of Tangent. We're all about hyper-facilitation, engagement, and interaction across class lines throughout our products, because through that's going to encourage an information and network exchange that can allow for kind of social mobility, if you like. So for us, we see like this a new world of work, one that is what we call decentralized. Right now, HR is very much centralized, right? It's just HR professionals who operate in isolation from the rest of the company. We see a decentralized HR function whereby all employees are actively involved in the HR function. We're seeing that happen already, and we just see a massive opportunity to build the product ecosystem super app, if you like, around that, whilst kind of transforming and reinventing the HR industry. But lots more to come on that over the coming years, but that's what we're working towards.
That's amazing to hear, and I'm super excited to see the business follow that path and no doubt have an even bigger impact on the world. So thank you for sharing that, Gary. With Sally and Em, we've got three final questions for you. So this is 40 Minute Mentor. Who would be your mentor, dead or alive, if you could choose and why?
I would say Rich Barton. So Rich Barton is the co-founder of three probably household companies now, Expedia, Glassdoor, and Zillow. They're all kind of network effect driven businesses, which is very much what Tangent is as well. So I just feel like I can learn a lot from him on that front. But Rich Barton was also a board director at a nonprofit in the US called Year Up, which is all about getting kind of like inner city young people from low income backgrounds into like meaningful careers. So I feel that I can learn a lot from him on the business front, from like the network effects alignment of both our companies. But also I feel like just the fact that he was a board director, we'd be quite mission aligned as well.
Love that. We will try to get him on the podcast and make this mentorship thing happen.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, definitely. And we've got a question roulette now. We've asked our audience to send you a couple of questions. So choose one, two, or three, if you don't mind, and we'll see what they have decided.
Three,
okay. You've been really active on LinkedIn over the last year. How has building your personal brand as a founder helped you raise Tangent's profile?
Okay, cool. So I'm definitely still on this journey and I just haven't tracked it. In many ways, you know, we get people reaching out for jobs lots of different like podcasts and speaking engagements, customers reaching out as well, investors. It definitely pays off. A lot of serendipity comes from, I think, being active on LinkedIn. So yeah, those are some of the ways that we've had, yeah, particularly on the talent front as well, some really incredible people have reached out wanting to write the tangent, which is quite, it's a really nice feeling. But on all fronts, it's been really, really useful.
Love that. Thank you. Yeah, we're seeing more and more the importance of personal brand and a great way to get your authentic voice across. And you're such an authentic person that it's a really great way for people to really get to know you, the mission behind Tangent, and hopefully become customers. So love that. Finally, Gary, what is one piece of career advice you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd say feel the fear and do it anyways. I remember being told that once by a colleague at LinkedIn. It just still resonates to me today. Like, so many things will scare you. So many things will keep you kind of there, just feel uncomfortable. That oftentimes those are the things that you should be doing, because that's when you'll grow and learn the most. I think one thing I've learned is that everyone feels the fear. Like, there's no one that has reached any level of success that hasn't felt nervous or anxious and so forth, but they just do it anyways. And either that it goes well for them or it doesn't, and they learn and they apply this learning to the next set of challenges or opportunities they have. So yeah, feel the fear, do it anyways. If something is making you feel nervous, anxious, uncomfortable, it's probably the thing to do.
Yeah, lean into it, embrace it. And I'm sure if we can encourage a few more people to do that, we'll probably have even more successful entrepreneurs like yourself, Gary. So thank you so much for joining us. I'm a massive fan of yours and Tangent's mission. So I'm really glad we've been able to talk through your story and inspire our audience. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's been great. I've listened to the show for a while, so it's been awesome to be here with you.
Oh, thank you so much. The pleasure was all mine.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I really hope that you found it useful and inspiring. If we have left any questions unanswered, or if you have any feedback or guest recommendations for future series, then please make sure you get in touch on info@jbmc.co.uk. I often get asked by listeners how you can help us spread the word about 40 Minute Mentor. There are two simple ways you can help. Firstly, share this episode on your preferred social media platform, and LinkedIn is probably where I'm most likely to see it. And you can also leave us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Every share on social media and review left on the podcast platforms really helps us to get 40 Minute Mentor in front of new audiences and share the power of mentorship even further. Thank you so much for your ongoing support, and I look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday for even more pocket-sized mentorship.